the next speaker, Bill Greenshields, who's such an important person in the whole of the education trade union movement, ex-president of the NUT. Bill, really pleased to have you here. Thanks very much.
News, I've retired actually from the from the education trade union movement, but even more bigger news, obviously, as this meeting is proving, representing, there is nothing very important about one person or 10 people or 1,000 people till they get together. It's the collective that is important, the collective that is strong and powerful. It's not 1,000 people sitting at their breakfast table saying, isn't it terrible? It's 1,000 people saying, we're not going to have it anymore. And I think that's the most important thing. Finished up there on democracy. I'll tell you something, just crossed my mind, so I hope you don't mind me sharing it with you. I became quite political at the age of about 14, and it was down to a teacher, actually. We called him Percy. I don't know what his name really was. But anyway, Percy Phillips, his name was. He was an economics teacher. And I just decided to want to do economics at school, to study economics at school. And he came in, it was a Friday afternoon, our first lesson, and he said, look, it's Friday afternoon, I don't know about you, but I've had enough this week, really. Wouldn't we be better all just going home and not bothering with it, and starting afresh next week? And it's a bit unusual from a teacher, you know, so we thought, well, yeah, everybody stayed a bit quiet. See, but, and he said, well, we better vote on it because, you know, I don't want to get into any trouble, so it better be everybody's wish. So everybody in favour of going home. And so we all put our hands up, we put his hand up. And he said, that's it then, right, leave them quietly, don't make a lot of noise. If you go past the head's office, be especially quiet and all the rest of it. And we started packing away, and he said, oh, there is one thing. He said, of course, they pay me to teach on a Friday afternoon, and I'm going to be a bit out of pocket as a result of this. How much money have you got on you? So we all started getting our pennies out, and he walked round up and down the roads, and he's going, 1, 2, 3... He got to the end, he said, well, that's nowhere near enough. He said, that's ridiculous, it's pathetic, it's nowhere near enough. He said, no, that's no good, we better get started, you know. And we said, but we had a vote. He said, oh, I see, you're making a fundamental and very basic mistake. What we did just now was democracy. But this is economic democracy. The first lesson of economics is the people with the money decide what happens. Now get your books out. I was staggered. I thought this isn't fair. And ever since then, I'm now 59. It's been proved to me that that is exactly right, and it is not a fair world. But things do change. There are moments set in diamonds, I think, you know, that actually where you can see people begin to move. And this is what democracy looks like. Like the students were chanting on their march, this is what democracy looks like. This is what democracy looks like. I was speaking to someone today, who was a very nice person, a very nice woman, but she said to me, you can't possibly justify what the students did at Millbank. You can't possibly do that, she said. We're sitting in an office, we had a cup of tea, it was all very nice, and she said, you can't possibly justify it. And I said, I won't take lessons about a few broken windows in London from the people who chose to blitz Belgrade and all around the world. No compunction about bombing Kabul, as they said at one time. The headline of the Sun was "Bye Bye Baghdad," if you remember. And they had no compunction about destroying the lives of ordinary working people when they feel they need to for their world order. And in consequence, a couple of 18-year-old students headbutting a pane of glass really pales it. But what it does, it demonstrates anger. So she said, well, anger isn't a good thing. Right. Well, I said, well, I'm angry because I feel that I'm being robbed. I feel that it's like somebody has robbed me, physically robbed me, taken my wallet, stolen it, because they need to pay back the people that have collapsed as a result of their activity. They are taking our money to make up for their crisis. And if we're not angry by that, if we're not made angry by that, that when it's translated into jobs, when it's translated into services, when it's translated into pensions, people will become increasingly angry, but not all together, not all at the same time. The students are simply the first. But we owe them a debt, because they have shown that you can get angry, you can legitimately get angry, and people can see what it's about. Is it just about the crisis? Is it about a financial crisis? You know, this, the Chinese don't have a single character for crisis. They have two. It's dangerous opportunity. And I think that's how we should see the economic crisis at the moment. A massive danger to ordinary working people, but a huge opportunity to, as well, to begin to assert ourselves, to say your system doesn't work. Your system has collapsed, and we are not paying for it. On the 7th of June this year, there was an unnamed Treasury spokesman who was named the following day. It was George Osborne, but he was unnamed on the 7th, but named on the 8th. And he said this: anyone who thinks the spending review is just about saving money is missing the point. This is a once-in-a-generation opportunity to transform the way that government works. And that's what they really have done. They've taken what they call this huge debt, this huge crisis, a debt that is nowhere near what it was at the end of the Second World War, that the government at the end of the Second World War built its way out of by building a welfare state, hospitals, schools, council houses, and built out its way out of that debt. But in fact, they're taking that debt, that recession, that crisis, as an excuse for attacking every single gain that we've made as workers since the end of the Second World War. Every aspect, you can't think of one that isn't, and people can't. Every aspect of working people's lives are under attack and under threat now. There is going to be no job security. There's going to be no proper pay. There is no proper benefits. And the services are being destroyed. Will you try and name something? I'm sure you've tried yourself and we know what it is. That is a declaration of war, comrades. It's this class struggles there all the time. We have to fight them all the time, backwards and forwards. It ebbs and flows. We win a bit, they take it back. They win a bit, we try to fight back. It's gone on all my life, and it'll go on for generations if we let it. But every now and again, in that, there's more than a struggle, there's a war, and there's got to be a winner. There was a war in the 1980s that focused on the miners, and then the printers, and so on, around that time. Steelworkers before that time. The destruction of industry was Thatcher and Reagan's, but Thatcher here, her plan was to destroy working class authority by destroying industry. They're now coming for what's left, and they're determined. When we went to see an MP about this in a lobby, and she was quite explicit about it. She said, no, there won't be unemployment, really, not for very long anyway, because it'll all get soaked up by the private sector. Now, it's a completely absurd argument anyway, because most of the private sector depends on the public sector for its existence. But what she was really saying, if it was quite clear between the lines, we're going to do away with the public sector and we're going to privatise it. We're going to cut away everything we need to. We're going to create a massive pool of unemployed. We're going to create a subclass of people who have no bloody future at all and have no hope, who we can use in whatever way we can. It's a breeding ground for racism and fascism there. And the rest of you will work for the private sector on reduced wages, on reduced conditions, on reduced pensions with no job security. That's your option, and that's what's going to happen. The big lie, of course, is we're all in it together, as another comrade there said. 120, I've got it as 130, but anyway, somewhere around there, £130 billion of tax evaded, avoided, or left uncollected. We asked this woman, this MP, why don't you make that your priority? You know what she said? She said, well, if we did, they'd all leave the country and take their wealth with them. Right? Well, apart from saying, tell them to shut the door, but, you know, that's what she said. But I said to her, you were in the paper just a few weeks ago saying that the RMT, the railway workers, were holding the country to ransom because they were coming out on a day's strike over health and safety issues on the tube. And now you tell me it's perfectly legitimate for the top 10% of the population, who own 87% of the wealth, to refuse to pay their taxes, and we allow them to do it because we must keep them here in the country. It's completely double talk, isn't it? If anyone's holding the country to ransom, it is that class of people. The arrogance of the banks, who are now predicted by the year end to make £90 billion in profits and bonuses by the year end 2010. You put those two together, 130 billion and 90 billion. What's that come to? It comes to 220 billion. What they say the deficit is? 150 billion. So, the big question is, what do we spend the other 70 billion on? That's what the People's Charter is about. I better come to the point, but that's what the People's Charter is about. Started a couple of years ago as a result of an article in the Morning Star, it was really, but a lot of trade unionists and other people, Labour lawyers, came together to discuss what would it look like if we were going to have a bit of a vision of Britain. They spent about a week sitting around talking about it, and they came up
with, funnily enough, something very akin to the 1945 Labour Manifesto. It took them an awful long time. They could have bought it on eBay for about 10 quid. But anyway, there it is. And it says, progressive taxations without loopholes, guaranteeing pensions, mortgages and savings, owning and controlling the banks, tying pensions and benefits to wages, protecting existing jobs, make a massive investment in green technology, create 3 million new publicly owned homes, energy, telecommunications, water and transport to be owned by all of us, remove profit making from NHS and schools, equality for all against racism and discrimination with equal pay, giving young people a future and training, free child and youth facilities and education, repeal the anti-union laws, no more blood and money for war, bring the troops home, no more billions for nuclear weapons, and so on. It's a charter which is modelled, in a sense, on the structure of the Old People's Charter in the 19th century, which brought together for the first time workers as a class. Rather than people fighting in little pockets, what the Chartists said was, we have to act together. They put 250,000 on Kennington Common, just down from where I was born. Now, we can do the same thing. The British working class have been divided and split over the years, lost confidence, been undermined by anti-trade union laws, by a little bit of over-caution on the part of union leaders, to put it mildly, by the new Labour clique in the Labour Party. They feel undermined. They're constantly told, know your place. This is far too difficult for you to understand. And even if you do understand, there's nothing you can do about it anyway. So that's what we're taught. And people have absorbed that. And some people do believe we're in this together. A lot of people believe that we're in this together. Still, despite the fact that you can see the disparities and the growing wealth-poverty gap, people think that we're in it together. Many people still believe it has to be done, that there is an alternative. They get it every day from all the media, apart from one or two magazines and newspapers that put an alternative point of view. But for the most part, they believe it. So I'm with the comrades here and say, we've got to build a movement which isn't just made us this fantastic turnout tonight, but isn't just this, because I bet probably most people here are in some way politically committed to a trade union or a political party or a pressure group. And there are millions of people out there who have never been involved in politics, who have never gone to a meeting, who have never been on a demonstration, who aren't in trade unions. And we have to build the most massive unity of those of us that were prepared to take a bit of a lead on this and reach down into the communities and insist on talking to people. And that means unglamorous work, knocking on doors and saying, we're going to be having a drink in the local pub in 20 minutes time, will you come and join us, we want to talk about the cuts, or going around and visiting places where we know that people have got, maybe to the employment offices where people go for casual work when we need to talk. But we've got to plan and work hard. I did think March was too far away. I don't think March is too far away now, because there needs to be a massive build-up regionally, locally, in order to reach those people. They are not going to be reached if we just advertise coaches. They're going to be reached by hard day-to-day work, through very painstaking work of all of us. And we have to fill, as Ben said, those coaches and those trains if we're going to get a million on the march. So there were people on the anti-war demonstration who've never been on a demonstration before. We have to create the same atmosphere, because it's the same thing. That was a war on Iraq. This is a war on the working class. And people are going to have to respond in that sense. I think we can do it. The People's Charter is just one of the many organisations that's springing up to put a different, slightly different perspective on the same battle. There's the Right to Work campaign, there's the Coalition of Resistance. They've organised a conference in London where they've got about 1,000 people signed up now on Saturday to go along to that. There's the People's Charter. There's all kinds of different organisations. The message from the left in the past is, if you put us all in one room, we'll end up scrapping with each other. The message this time has got to be total unity around what is obvious, that is the defence of trade. Can we win it? I don't think we can stop the cuts without bringing the government down. That's my view. They're not going to help. So, can we bring the government down? Of course we can. Of course we can. If a million British people were marching, a million workers in Britain got up, 2 million, 5 million, if people decided that government will go, it will go. There is no doubt about it. But it's inherently, as a comrade said, weak. It's got massive fracture points in it all the time. And if we focus on them, dividing them as they seek to divide us, splitting them apart like they tried to split us apart while we maintain our unity, we can not only stop the cuts, we can stop that government. We'll have a new election, and then there will be a big question, guys. Who is going to replace them? What type of government do we want? What kind of policies do we want them to pursue? And how far will we be prepared to defend a progressive government? Because if we elected a progressive government, they would be under immediate pressure from the world system that props up this rotten way that we live at the moment, props up the bankers and puts them back in power all the time. We have to think, what would we do in an election? But first, let's create the conditions of it. We, in unity, can defeat the government. We will win this.
Yeah. Well done.